T.S. Eliot was a poet, essayist, publisher, playwright, literary critic, and editor. He is considered to be one of the 20th century's greatest poets, as well as a central figure in English language modernist poetry. His trials in language, writing style, and verse structure reinvigorated English poetry. He is also noted for his critical essays, which often re-evaluated long-held cultural beliefs. But last week, after opening a trunk purchased at an estate sale, Shonda Clarne, a London retiree, made a discovery that changes everything we know about Eliot.
At first, I thought the trunk was just filled with ladies' slippers, but then I realized that inside each slipper was a handwritten poem, each signed by T.S. Eliot.
The poems were sent to Dr. Amanda Humpney of the Royal Literary Society for analysis and verification.
When I saw these poems for the first time, I nearly wept. It was as though I were alone in the room with Eliot. There on the paper, dotted by dried yellow dots of Eliot's tea, were undiscovered writings by one of the greatest poets in modern history. These poems are classic Eliot. Bundled within them are all of Eliot's desires and longings. Take Panty Line, for example.
A line that stretches cross a yard, thin, tenuous, febrile, yet firm. A silken tendon of drying. And like flags, the panties dangle there free-flying, drying but still moist in the morning air and like spider-blown for a moment, from his shimmering web left to float in that place between earth and sky. I crawl quietly through the yard, returning to the panty line.
Here Eliot captures the poignant, transient beauty of a clothesline, a symbol of life itself upon which we tread like a tight rope walker. And then we have Coming Stone, where Eliot writes about a visit to a cemetery.
The light that shines upon the stone is not enough to make me come, and so my legs, they carry me softly through the morning breeze. At last I find a coming stone that marks the home of ancient bones, and draw forth spray and decorate the grave they say I desecrate.
But my favourite of all of them is Yellow. You can almost hear Eliot crying out for his mother.
Man I may be with chest of hair and bearded chin firm and square, but in moonlight with no one there it's yellow diaper that I wear, and who shall hear my rattle, who shall fill my bottle as I lay alone upon the floor, gazing sadly at the door, I come till I can come no more.
The handwritten poems, now verified by the London Literary Verification Society, are valued at over £7,000 and will go on auction next week.
Friends, it is I, D. Trussell, and what you just heard was the singing of the garbled chaos warbler. I'm sad to say that these birds were hunted to extinction by idiots who didn't understand how beautiful their song truly was. Oh, how lucky you were if you heard the song of a chaos warbler outside your window. And it fills me with such grim rage to picture the final moments of the final chaos warbler who landed in front of the window of a New Yorker who decided to smash it to death with a Bible. I'm so fucking pissed off. All I've been doing is smoking weed and snorting rails of Xanax. anything to help me not feel the trembling anger that has caused my remaining ball to suction up deep into my tank. I'm not going to keep raging and ranting here, but I just want you to know I'm really upset right now, and I hope whoever killed the last Chaos Warbler is real happy. I hope they're out there in New York City having some pizza pie and feeling real good about what they did, because the world is watching you, or someone probably is watching you, or should be. I hope someone watches you for a long time. We got a great podcast for you today. Connor Habib has returned, and you know, whenever Connor Habib comes back, it is fire, it is beauty, it is brilliance. And this, I think, is the best podcast we ever did together. Before we jump into that, though, I would love to invite you to come to some of my shows. If you happen to be listening to this the week of November 14th, I'm going to be in Salt Lake City. If you tried to get tickets and realize, holy shit, it's sold out, we added not just one extra show, which also sold out, but another extra show on Sunday. So if you go to the Wise Guys website, or go to my website, or go to my Instagram, you can find ticket links to the remaining show that we just added. I hope that you will come out. I'm taking 2 weeks off. There won't be any DTFHs for 2 weeks or any stand-up, but I'm coming back December 14th. I'm going to be at the Comedy Zone in Charlotte, NC, December 14th through the 16th. Don't sleep on getting those tickets. You can find them at DuncanTrussell.com. I'm praying that it's not an anomalous phenomena that I sold out Wise Guys in Salt Lake City, and that all my shows are going to start selling out so that my ego will get a massive boner. You can find the Comedy Zone tickets at DuncanTrussell.com. And then after that, I'm going to be at the Comedy Works January 11th, Helium Comedy Club in Indianapolis January 25th. The Comedy Works is in Denver. Then you can find me at Hyenas in April. And there's a lot of dates in between that I have yet to put up on my website, so I should probably get on that. All right. Oh, and subscribe to the Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. You'll get commercial-free episodes of this podcast. And eventually, I'm going to upload an entire hour of me just plugging random shit with no podcast attached. So you just get a whole hour of me going on and on and on plugging things. But first, I have to finish designing my signature set of DTFH nipple extenders and clamps. They're coming. Don't worry. Today's guest, Connor Habib, has a wonderful podcast that I hope you all will definitely check out. It's called Against Everyone with Connor Habib. He also wrote an amazing book called Hawk Mountain. And this is very important, he has an upcoming event that I hope you all will sign up for. It's called Occult Philosophies, An Intro to Rudolf Steiner and the Western Esoteric Tradition with Connor Habib. That's Saturday, December 2nd. I'm telling you, this man that you're about to listen to is a genius. I love chatting with him. And if you are interested in having your mind blown, smattered all about, exploded, then recombinated, is that a word? Rearranged. Like, you know, you see those kids who can do the Rubik's Cube in like a second with a whirl of their hands and it just rearranges. That's what he will do to your mind. If you want to sign up, go to ConnorHabib.com, click on events. You can find all the upcoming events there and you can sign up. But now, won't you listen to this wonderful conversation with my dear friend, Connor Habib? Connor, welcome back to the DTFH, my friend. It's so good to see you.
Here we go again. It's great to see you too.
Here we go again. Now I'm looking at the background of your beautiful Irish home. I got some, seeing some books there on the shelf. You got candles burning. What part of the house is that? Do you have like a study or what am I looking at there?
It's just the front room. I've turned the front room into like, yeah, where we sit and watch TV, but there's also like my little work desk and everything, which I think like anybody wants to be a writer or do any kind of creative thing, they have to have their own space. Like they really 100%. Have to have their own space. It makes such a difference to clear it out and then reopen it with the intention. So rather than using a whole room in the house, we do have a room upstairs that's just like a reading room. But rather than like that, I have just a desk against the wall. I have like a painting above me that you can't see and like a tree and everything. And it feels like I'm in a different room when I do this. Like, you know what it's like when you set the space. It does transport you. And I tell every writer that I work with or whatever, I'm like, make a space. Yeah.
100%. You know, I feel like one of the many linguistic disservices of the post-industrial revolution society that we're existing in is the word office. Mm. So like we are limited, just shoved into this stupid word for our creative spaces. So you call it a fucking office. It's not an office. It's a laboratory. You call it an occult chamber. And, you know, whatever you want to call it, an alchemical laboratory, whatever you want to call it. But office, I mean, truly, if you want to defang linguistically what it is you do in a space where you're creating, call it a fucking office. It's an office. It's like I do my filing here.
Even, I mean, and I say this word sometimes, but even workspace, like I don't like that. Oh, yeah.
Workspace. It's a shared workspace. These motherfuckers, man, they're so good. Like you want to talk about this, the sorcerers that live on this fucking planet. They are so good at making everything about work. Mundanity, you know what I mean? Like just turning, what's it called? Sad beige mom. You ever heard of this?
No, but I get it already. Yeah.
you get it, right? It's like this impulse that happens where they just want everything to be beige. It's something like happens in their brain. It's postpartum. I'm sorry, beige moms. But like, yeah, they just beige it down, man. Beige it down. And like, similarly, these sorcerers, man, they just want to like, yank the fucking teeth. They want to declaw the cat, basically.
Yeah, you know what the whole shape of that is, dude? It's like, you know, remember like you would get this like sticky pillow attachment thing to put on the phone so you could like lean your head over and like hold the corded phone up against. Like we had one of those in my house when I was a kid and it was beige. And it was that weird kind of like, you know, like squished pupa shape that like you'd lean over and hold it. And it also had the weirdest like texture. It was like kind of plastic, but kind of soft. And all it was so you could tilt and like just fucking ruin your neck and spine and vertebra so you could like talk on the corded phone. And it was beige. And that's the shape of their spell. Like it's the shape of that gross phone pillow.
Pupa.
Yeah.
Pupa. I'll tell you, man, if I was like a demon or if I was running some organized demonic experiment, number one, would not keep hell the same. Like I would do various experiments in hell, be like, okay, this millennia, let's do beige. We're gonna do like phones and like it will be a pupa. Like they won't see that they're cradling a pulsating demonic larva under their head, but it shall be a larva, and that'll be funny because they won't know they're cradling a demonic impregnated fucking demonic caterpillar.
Yeah. That's and where we'll capitalism comes like, from. Yeah.
You know, the last time we tried to do hell, we let them have their alchemical laboratories and they almost defeated us with their metaphysical power. So let's call them offices this time. Make sure we limit the scope of what they do this time to filing.
Right. Like if we find Atlantis, like we find, you know, all the sunken city of Atlantis, the reason why it fell is you just find those beige filing cabinets and like just like the clawed staple removers and stuff like that. Nothing too advanced, you know. That was
paper clips everywhere. Yeah, paper clips, malfunctioning printers. Well, Connor, so, you know, we decided to do this podcast because you have a class coming about the occult and Rudolf Steiner. And so, I mean, that's a pretty broad topic. How do you, like, when you start a class like that in the occult, like, what's day one look like?
Well, this is, it's only one day. So day one and
day zero
are the same. Yeah.
Hey, time's just an illusion, baby. So this is one.
To quote Daniel Higgs, the one first day is looming, the last day is near. Yeah.
So what does it look like? How do we, how do you teach about this? Is this for advanced students?
It could be like, it could be for people that are interested in it, you know, already and have some, so it's called Occult Philosophies, an Intro to Rudolf Steiner in the Western Esoteric Tradition. And basically, you know, and this is, I hope we just talk about this episode, because I've just been noticing world events. I mean, you can't help but notice them. I mean, they seize hold of you. And I was like, okay, so what's actually needed right now? And I know that some of what's needed is for people to connect with, you know, spirit, to connect with their spirituality. There are other people that are, you know, working on that. But for me, I look at my spirituality as coming from the Western esoteric tradition with Rudolf Steiner as a singular figure. But I particularly mean like esoteric Christianity, and Rudolf Steiner is the big figurehead of that. So I'm not like a Steinerite, or, you know, even maybe his system is called Anthroposophy, even Anthroposophist exactly, but I find a lot to draw on from there. And so I decided to just offer this kind of basic introductory course. Like, the guy has 6,000 lectures, he has dozens of books, and he's really kind of, in some ways, difficult to grasp. And so I'm just going to lead people through some of the basic concepts, but also offer some experiential exercises that we can do. You know, like you and I did, like, on one of the episodes we did together, I kind of led you through
I think about it once a week. Yeah. So, I'm not joking. Right? I think about it once a fucking week when I let you into my head with that Steiner magic. I do. I really do, man. My mind. It was.
Thanks. Yeah, you're so funny. You called me, I think on that episode, you were like, you're a living psychedelic substance. And I just had a guest on the show, Pilar Lesko. She's just this incredible, like, money esoteric worker person. She's so cool. And she said the same thing to me. She was like, you're like living LSD. And I was like, thank you. The only other person that said that to me was Duncan Trust. She's like, I love Duncan. So I like being active, you know, an activating substance for people in that way. Hope this course will be that too, because there's some, I'm not doing it to like give people sensationalistic experiences or anything. It's to lead them through so they can understand. There's a quote from Rudolf Steiner where he kind of said, exasperated to all the people that are coming to visit him and listen to him, he was like, I don't want you to believe me. I want you to understand me. And so that's what I'm trying to do, is offer some understanding to something that seems otherwise really dense, even though it's been picked up and influenced so many people. Like, it's influenced Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring and started the environmental movement, Vandana Shiva, the seed activist. I mean, some people that you would know, like John Cusack, and, you know, Tilda Swinton helped start a small Rudolf Steiner school. It's behind Waldorf Education, biodynamic farming, community shared agriculture, Camp Hill communities, and then like lots of experimental artists that people know, Hilmar Klint and Vasily Kandinsky, Joseph Beuys.
I don't know. Kandinsky. Okay. Yeah. I love Kandinsky.
Or like, you might know the filmmaker Andrei Tarkovsky, who did Stalker and Solaris. He was basically an anthroposophist. So people are like deeply influenced by it. And nobody really in the US knows that much about it. And for me, whenever there are, I think you do this too. It's something that's really like cool about your show, is whenever there are times where everything feels really condensed and heavy, like things are just like almost like a hardened collapsed star, you know, and it feels like there's nowhere to go and there's nowhere to breathe. it's so important to turn to the things that seem wild and impossible and almost like just nuts, because then suddenly everything starts opening up and all these new possibilities right. become available in your imagination and therefore your ability to act and direct things. So that's why this is so important to me now and why I'm offering it.
Okay, this reminds me, and I'm sure he's influenced by Steiner, Jodorowsky. One of my favorite Jodorowsky quotes is, sometimes you got to kick over the ant's nest and watch them build it back up. And, you know, it's like that, right? I mean, it's like we're talking this, you know, the tendency in the universe, things coalesce, densify, and then there's this form that happens, and which is great if you want to like live on a planet, have a house, you need coalesced matter. But when it happens to you and you coalesce, you know what I mean, too much, and then you start resisting the very thing that got you there in the first place, that's where, that to me, that's, and anytime that happens, this is where I start getting depressed, start getting grumpy, shitty. Is this, so that's what you're talking about, like this is a sort of methodology of deconstructing whatever kind of condensed egoic form you happen to be stuck in.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, for me, it's definitely in my own personal life and then just in the life of the world. And obviously there's a lot of, shall we say, painful exchange between those two that's going on in people's lives right now. They see the world and they feel there are no options. People really feel as if we have lost the power to direct things. But in fact, we are a part of it and we do have the power to direct things. But before we can actually access that, we have to feel like, oh, I can direct things. So before we access actually directing things, we have to get in touch with the thinking and the feelings and the ability to act that is like, oh, I actually can change things. And usually the contraction of that, the inaccessibility of that, is due to people not feeling like there are any options to them because they're only looking at what's in front of them. And usually when the world has gone so crazy, it's because the options that they think they have, choice A or choice B, are bound together. I mean, the easiest way for Americans, I think, to understand that is like Democrat, Republican, two-party politic, whatever.
Right.
And then, you know, they desperately scramble like, well, what if we had a third party candidate? But what I'm saying is like, let's, you know, first we can go beyond that totally and say, why do we have political parties? But then we go beyond that and say, like, why this structure at all? Why these economic, cultural, and political structures at all, when there could be something completely different available to us?
Right.
And all it takes is us to sort of move into a different way of approaching that unfurls into action and connectivity with others.
Is it okay? Can you, is it like a, are we talking about like some kind of initial faith or like a faith that like there is the possibility of change that doesn't look like the change you're used to? Is that what it, like, it, does it start with that kind of like, you know, that's something that excites me. Is there every once in a while, I remember, wait, it can be totally, profoundly different than the way it is right now. What that difference looks like, I don't know. But just, you know what I mean? I plug into that imminent possibility. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the faith part, I would maybe say it a little differently. It's just observation of how the world has worked. I mean, if you look at your own life and see how much you've changed. I mean, just you and I have known each other for a really long time, and we've seen each other change quite radically, I think, over the years.
I became straight and you turned gay.
Yeah, as a result of having sex.
I know. I thought we were never going to tell anybody. We agreed. Okay.
No, I just one brush of that beard against my balls, and suddenly I
we were roommates.
So I just to say, like, you know, you can observe in your own life how radically you've changed. You can also observe how radically nature, which we consider to be permanent, has changed. You can examine how things like, you know, social mores have changed in your own lifetime up till now. And we're not even dead yet, right? Like, and so much has changed. And so just to remember that change is available to us at all times, but even more radical than that. So that maybe there's a little bit of faith there, but I would just start with the observation that so much is available. And if you just start in your imagination, I mean, this isn't something that I'm going to go over in the course, but if you just close your eyes and I tell you to imagine one thing, like a chair, and then I tell you to imagine a dragon, you can do it just like that, right? So
no problem.
It's as profound as that. That's what's available to us, because it's happening in our thought world. And I'm not talking about manifesting stuff. It takes more than just manifestation and wanting and desire and all that. I mean, maybe that can be a part of it, but it takes a guiding through in a certain way. So, you know, I mean, just, I think, I can't remember if I've said this on the show before, but I remember Grant Morrison, the comic book writer, you know, talking about how he grew up with, you know, parents who were against nuclear weapons, and I think nuclear power plants as well, but like nuclear bombs. And he said they were fighting against it all the time. And he's like, and I came to realize at a certain point that nuclear weapons were an idea before they became, you know, these material things. And Superman was also an idea. So I figured I would work on bringing Superman into the real. And so everything's an idea, you know, everything has this spiritual form before it descends into matter and solidifies. So that's what I'm talking about.
That is cool. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the unnerving aspect to that, because there's something unnerving about that. You know, there's something like death wrapped up in it, not like physical death, but there's something in there where it's like, hey, wait a minute, I don't want to let go of my security blanket here. Mm-hmm. You're asking me to put down literally everything, and it's scary as fuck, because it's not a blanket, it's the entire way that you're interpreting reality, and also within the possibility that within that reinterpretation, reality itself will alter.
Yeah.
Does Steiner talk about that woozy kind of feeling you get when you brush up against that possibility?
Level after level after level of it. In fact, at every unfolding or opening of spiritual development, a new terror, a new wooziness, as you call it, occurs. And it, in some ways, getting through one level of spiritual development does not prepare you for the next, which is even more frightening. It can strengthen you, but it doesn't necessarily prepare you to see or to overcome or even see the challenge. And so, I think one of those earlier levels is like, well, what do I do if I let go of the idea that the world is made of objects and motion, and instead see the truth, which is that the world is composed of evolving states of consciousness. So now that falls away, I'm going to have to do something else here. I'm going to have to see things in a different way. And then when you start doing that, I just want to be careful to not say this to just create the lure of novel, exciting, weird experiences. Those all do happen, but weird shit starts to happen. Weird things start to unfold once you start engaging in that way. And it can be quite frightening. For instance, what happens when you take your thoughts as seriously as objects, then you become responsible for them. And that's something to deal with. that's something to contend with. It's not always easy, for sure. And you know that they can affect people. You know, actually, your thoughts have an effect in the world. And that is true of everybody already. But once you wake up to it, it becomes even more true and more challenging. So,
okay, help me understand that. So in my Buddhist training, or whatever you want to call it, you know, in Buddhism, you'll hear a thing like the mind creates thoughts the way the tongue salivates. There's this noting is what it's called. So when my mind produces what these days people call intrusive thoughts, what I do is I go thinking so that I don't get grabbed by the intrusive thoughts, sucked in, lost in a universe of horror from that intrusive thought. Just let it go. But it seems like what you're saying is there's some possibility of shaping the thought prior to its emergence. I think most people think of thinking as a kind of spontaneous emergence of some form, some daydream, whatever it may be. But are you saying that we can sort of incubate thoughts or intentionalize our thinking? How does that work?
Yeah, intentionalize our thinking is probably is probably the closer way for me of identifying with what you said. So something you're getting to there is that our thoughts and our thinking are not the same thing. The thoughts are the cast off objects of the activity of thinking. And the activity cool. of thinking is what we strive for in spiritual development. The working with the thoughts is something that people work with in self-development and in new age self-helpy kind of stuff. And I don't discredit any of that. I think it all has its value up to a certain point. Everything has its value. But sure. to the extent that it starts setting you back and concealing the fact that it set you back is where I start to worry. So just whenever if I make any sort of seemingly judgmental things as we talk about this, about psychedelics.
Judge away. Let me pause you just for quick. My best friends, and I think of you as one of them, even though we never fucking talk, they brutalize my woo-woo spiritual stuff. And I love it. Like it never offends me. And it usually it like helps me. So please don't nerf whatever you're going to say. And I don't think any of, and if you offend a few people, so what? Like, go for it, man. Like, cut our throats. Cut our throats on top of your Steinarian cigarette.
Yeah. Okay, good. I mean, good. I will. It's just to say, like, listen, don't turn away from what's being said because you think, I mean, look, I've done all kinds of fucking crazy shit that spiritual people condemn quite clearly in my life. If you just want to look me up on the internet, you'll find like 200 instances of it easily, you know? So like, I'm not condemning anybody for doing anything. So, okay. But I will be a little more assertive. So
what are you talking about, your tweets?
No, I'm talking about my dick. So it used to be in my tweets, but isn't so much these days. So I would just say, like, when we engage with our thinking, we're engaging with something different than our thoughts. There's an active process of thinking, and can we get engaged with that in an intentional way? So I like you said, intentionalize our thinking. So I say, thinking intentionally, feeling with purity, and acting with purpose. That's where I would go with all three of these things in just sort of layman's terms. It's
how. Can you say that again?
Yeah. Thinking with intention, feeling with purity, and acting with purposefulness.
I want. do that now with microdose gummies. I want to thank Lumi Labs, not just for supporting the DTFH for so long, but for creating the delicious, wonderful microdose gummies. Friends, there is no reason for you to overdose yourself on edible weed anymore. There's no reason for you to pick up a suspicious looking candy and eat it and send your brain straight to the depths of hell. Lumi Labs has taken care of all of the problems that used to torture us when we would eat edibles. My friends, this is my favorite edible. It is legal nationwide. That means you can fly with it. They can mail it to you. It's available in every state. These darling things help me fall asleep on time. I wake up rested, and I love working out on them. I'm telling you, I would not lead you astray. I just take half of one of these sweeties and I am doing great. Microdose, they are available nationwide. You can learn more about microdosing THC by going to microdose.com. Use code Duncan to get free shipping and 30% off your first order. Links can be found in the show description, but again, it's microdose.com, code Duncan.
Thinking with intention, feeling with purity, and acting with purposefulness. How many times do we do any of those things? Really, it's very, very, very rare. So this is something that, you know, Rudolf Steiner, and I would just say Christian esotericism in general has brought to me, is being able to try to access all of that and sometimes succeeding, mostly failing, whatever. But when you talk about thoughts and you're asking me about this, thoughts being as real as objects. Again, thoughts are sort of cast off, but we, and I think Buddhists would agree in, well, some in this sense, we latch on to some of them, right? We get distracted from that process, that activity of thinking, and we end up latching onto certain thoughts.
Right.
The thoughts in our heads are mostly the voices of a congregation of beings that meet in our address. So they come to speak, they come to appear, they come to do things, to juggle, to make weird sounds, to make shapes, to whatever. And to the extent that our thinking activity is not alive, it just ends up becoming a stagnant pool that one of these voices, these entities can drink from and drink from and drink from. And it's become bigger and bigger and stronger until they become, you know, something that is interfering with our feelings and therefore unfurling itself into our actions.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. So it's some kind of like energy or like it's like a pool of mana or something. And you're saying that these entities, one of them, if you're not careful, takes over. The other ones are still there, right? Like from this perspective, they're still there, but they're being drowned out by whichever one has like become the loudest. Is this, and let me add to the question, is this to be taken literally? Like Steiner would say, there's entities inside of you. Okay.
Yeah, definitely literally. And this is something that I try to work with when I talk with people about this kind of stuff. Is that I don't want them, again, I don't want them to believe me like Rift. I want them to maybe have a little bit of an experience for this of themselves, but it takes a while to begin to understand that it's actually literal. So I always give a kind of double vision of it. It's like, what's the value even if you can't go there with me? So that's something I always try to do. So I just want to preface it with that. Like in the class, I do that, but elsewhere I do. I'm like, well, like, for instance, if you don't believe in reincarnation, which is something that I would probably bring up in this course, like, what would be the value of believing in it, even if you didn't believe in it? What could it bring to you in your life if you accept it? So that to me is important. But when we talk about those beings, just I think the easiest way to visualize it, is to think, you know, well, I mean, there's a Midnight Gospels-y thing, but like, it's just hard to imagine a fairy tale, like someone walking through the fairy market, as soon as they stop at one stall and take that apple from that little goblin, like they're there for 100 years, you know, like right. Everything else is whirring and buzzing around them, but they're just, that's a great image of it.
Right. That's so cool. Yeah. I mean, I wonder if you could, immediately what comes to mind is one of my favorite stories from the New Testament. Jesus and the disciples go to this island. There's this lunatic living in a graveyard. Everyone's afraid of him. They try to chain him down, but he breaks the chains. And this is, God knows, this has been like put in a million exorcism movies. But Jesus goes to talk to this poor human, and he says, "We are legion. We are legion." Like, you know, implying it's not just one demon in there. It's a hive of demons. Jesus then does some form of exorcism, sends the demons into the pigs, into some poor farmer's freaking pigs. Not cool. Pigs run off the cliff. All of them die, and leaving the pig farmer fucked. And so then I think they kind of have to like flee the island, because like people, though they're glad the lunatic has been exercise, they're like, "Hey, what about our pigs?" And he was like, "See ya. I'm not getting you more pigs." So is that from the Christian mysticism perspective, is that, in other words, whenever I've heard that, I've always thought, oh, those are demons. But it feels like what you're saying is, no, we all have spirits in us. Every one of us is possessed by not one, but many, a plethora of entities.
Yeah. I mean, let me see what I can do with that. Like, in that case, there was a demon thing happening. Demons aren't singular. They are congregants that become so overwhelming for one reason or another. And, you know, it's different whenever that they speak collectively. You know, the I, the ego, is something that is singularly human. So for a demon, can't even really access that too much. It can by sort of directing or coercing the person that it's inhabiting. But if a demon's going to speak through someone in its voice, it's going to be a we, because it's a congregation that has to come together to overwhelm. Wow. But for us,
creepy.
For us, with all the sort of beings that are mean, no, those aren't demonic, and that's not possession. In fact, everything is made out of these beings. Our bodies, our organs, everything is this interlocking. Because that's what I said, evolving states of consciousness. This inner working, interweaving spiritual world that composes and maintains all of us all the time, happening even now as we speak, and we're creating more as we speak. Like, if you could just see the room filling up with them, you know, we'd have no room in like 2 seconds, because our concepts, our words, our interactions, the letters that make up the words of the concepts that we're saying, the gestures, the feelings, it's all just like a constant adding machine, you know? So
it's like when you shake up carbonated soda, all the bubbles. Yeah. It's like those freaking things. Right. I know the ones you're talking, I mean, I've seen them on mushrooms. Like, all of a sudden you're just like, what the fuck? They're everywhere. There's so many. Uh-huh. It's like, it's amazing. Like, I know what you mean. No room. Mm-hmm. Like, it's more than like New York. It's just everywhere. So keep going. Sorry.
No, that's it. So just to say, like, we shouldn't mistake the beings for demonic just because they're being. I mean, our bodies are made out of that.
Right.
There's an aspect of us that is not that. And that is the true self. That is the true being. Now, that's, I think, where Buddhism and, you know, Western esoteric Christianity would part ways, because there'd be, in some cases of Buddhism, there are some Buddhisms that don't, you know, but that there is no self ultimately. But I say there is a self, and that self is eternal, and everything else dies, everything else goes away. But that self is absolutely eternal, and it is never suffering, and it is always with us. And time itself is not able to contact or touch that. And that's something.
Well, that, okay, yeah. Let's talk about that self. Sorry. That self, is that an individualized self or a sort of super self that everyone is sharing in?
In the same way that Christ was the Son of God and God, that's what we're talking about.
That makes, I don't think that that actually, I don't think that veers too far away from my understanding of it. It's just, it's not like, you know, especially in the world, and you know, if you're raised in capitalism, not knocking capitalism, everyone gets that, not capitalism, look at you, not knocking, but if you're conditioned to believe in like boundaries and fences and walls and mine and yours, then the moment you contact that thing that you're talking about or have any sense of it, you want to put a nice border wall around it and say myself, yourself,
right?
Whereas it's not really it doesn't really belong to anybody. If that's what you're talking about, then I think it does align with Buddhism.
Yeah, I mean, we are in some ways completely individuated, and in other ways we are all united in spirit. The economy, actually, it's interesting you bring up capitalism, because the economy is an outpicturing of what I'm talking about. The economy is the all. So the culture is the individual. It's just one person. That's sexuality, art, you know, your imagination, even science to some extent is really an individualized, I'm going to try this and feel this and, it, you know, observe an experiment.
Yeah.
Politics is two or more people. When you're trying, the political rights realm is, how do we negotiate an equality when two people come together? And then the economy is the all. The economy is everybody, the fraternity. Okay. So it's all the breaks and flows, all the resources, all the commons we draw from. And so the economy in some ways is an outpicturing of the reality of the spiritual world, where we are all actually interconnected. We are all, but we are individuated as well. So, you know, just to maybe to say, one of the things that I want people to contact through esoteric Christianity is that truth of the interconnectedness, but it does bring pain and suffering to be able to touch that. And that's hard. Like, who wants to be like, I'm going to do spiritual development so I can hurt? But it's also hurting to move beyond the kinds of hurt that we normally feel. So, you know, I'm thinking about Rudolf Steiner giving what we would call first responders, emergency aid people, a meditation to work with when they went to meet other people. Because, you know, like, if you're surrounded by bodies, people that have been massacred, blown up, mutilated, if you're surrounded by people who are in extreme harm, and you have to help them, you start to absorb and feel that. Like, you have to be able to mediate all of that. So here's the meditative verse he gave. As long as you feel pain that I avoid, Christ remains unrecognized. Mm-hmm. At work in cosmic being, for weak is the spirit that can feel suffering only in its own body. So, as soon as I start to access the truth, I begin to also access the pain of the other. Now, that is hard to mediate, but I also think that we're experiencing that now. Anyway, we're getting a teeny, teeny, tiny hit of it. Not the real thing, which is even worse. I've actually experienced someone else's pain. I began to experience and be able to see, you and I actually talked about this on my show, I was able to see someone else's day through their own eyes. I was experiencing the pain that they were going through, not just my own pain, but theirs. And
yes,
when that happened, that was just one person, and it was screamingly, absolutely unbearable. If you think about all the pain and suffering you've gone through in your life, now imagine also feeling someone else's from start to finish in their life to wherever they are now. Now imagine feeling everybody's. So that's actually coming for us. That's opening up in the world. That's going to be an experience that we all have, and nobody's really prepared to mediate that.
I keep hearing that. Let's talk about that. What is the, why? This is the second time in two podcasts where I've heard a version of this imminent sort of lifting of the boundaries separating us from like true experience. What is that? Where does that come from?
Yeah. So think about the interconnectedness that's been opening and opening since, well, I'll take an arbitrary point because we can go back more than this, but since we went to the moon. So since someone was on the moon, if you believe people went to the moon, since someone was on the moon and could see the entirety of our existence. So even if no one was on the moon, we'll just say that picture of the Earth is real. Okay. I'll accept that whether or not you, I mean, I don't know about that. I don't even think
it's fucking real. Okay. God damn it, Leo. We got to tap dance around these motherfuckers. Yes, it's real.
I actually don't know. It's one of those things I don't really think about that much. But then I think about it, I'm like, it's weird. It's weird that that happened. But yeah, it's real. So
same, honestly, same. I don't know. I just wanted to seem a little more scientific. I wanted to do Neil deGrasse Tyson. I don't know, man. Sometimes I'm like, I don't think that's real. Okay.
So... saying the things that no one else will say. The moon landing was real. So since we saw the entirety of existence, that has been of spatial existence for human beings, that's been growing and growing as a phenomenon in our lives. I mean, you could see that just in the expansion of how many people are we connected to. Then definitely during COVID and lockdowns, it was like, I'm sitting alone in my house in one room, and I'm thinking about the entirety of experience of everybody else on the planet and what they're going through and how we might affect each other. That's been growing and growing and growing. And the internalization of the awareness of the other has been growing in us like a new form of consciousness. Wow. And it's not stopping. It's not stopping. And so now we're beginning to, and, you know, certainly social media is also an expression of that. The news, the nonstop news cycle is an expression of that. But no one can escape anymore. I mean, if anybody's paid any attention to anything, it's like, where do I go to like get away? And let me just bring that back to the economy picture I was saying before. People, even people who are completely so wealthy that they could kind of extract themselves from all the news and all the things that were happening, when there were lockdowns, they still experienced limitation and a brushing up against the other. Now, there are probably a few people in the universe, in the world, whose wealth is not measured by money, who probably weren't affected at all. But even the ultra wealthy had to go through all kinds of hoops that they never had to go through before. They saw what was happening. They probably knew some people who died. I'm not equating their suffering with the people who, you know, had 10 family members living in one house and like 9 of them died or something like that. I'm just saying that altering of how we're all connected that happened then was massive. It also affected, because it was massive, it affected the economic realm, which is why money in some ways is all fucked up right now as well, because the idea that money was your ticket out of being connected to the all, connected to everybody, has been canceled. Yeah. That doesn't work anymore. So now that faith in the economic realm has been shaken and is trying to find its new form right now.
Okay. This is, I think another way to put it would be, I don't care how, like if you're in a swimming pool, and there's an area of the swimming pool reserved for the elites. If I shit in the shallow end, There's still shit in the pool, baby. Right. You gotta get out. You're gonna get. It's the way it is. Like, you know, that's what you're talking about. It's like we're all in the swimming pool. It doesn't matter if you have like some fancy side of the pool. Mm-hmm. We are all connected, and you know, maybe I feel like what you're saying is like there was a time, surely there was, where you thought your island or your little area was the sum total of all things. It was still a swimming pool. It was just a much smaller swimming pool. But now we're realizing, oh my God, it's a planet-sized swimming pool. And I guess what you're saying is pretty soon we're going to start realizing it's a universe-sized swimming pool, maybe. Like that,
right.
And that is going to if that's going to hurt if you have the impression that you're going to be okay.
Yeah, if you have no investment in cleaning the water, you know, like, and there's a sewer leak, you know, a sewer pipe like leaking into it, you know.
Yeah.
There are some people who have, I suppose there are a few people here and there whose wealth is not just a version of being, you know, farther down on the deep or shallow end. But But most people.
I got you, man.
Yeah.
So, And so this is an evolving, what we're looking at here, this is sort of like a process that is unfolding right now and becoming impossible to ignore.
Yeah. I mean, it's what we should go through. I'm glad we're going through it. You know, there's a lot that's happening. I mean, this connection to each other through spirit is quite incredible, and it can and will be beautiful, but we have to figure out how much suffering we want to deal with before we access that aspect of it. And I think most people,
right,
one of the reasons why I'm teaching the course, why I talk about any of the things I talk about, is because I think most people aren't remotely ready, so things end up being extremely like traumatizing shock to them after shock after shock after shock. And then what a lot of spiritual people do to deal with that is just pretend it's not real and do like a, what is that? Advaita Vedanta. Is that what you call that? Like stream of everything's perfect. Everything's energy. Everything.
I don't whatever. Call it that.
Yeah.
We call that bullshit in the school of Buddhism. I've been you don't get out like that. You don't get to, I know. I mean, you can say everything's perfect if you're some enlightened super being, and but when they're saying everything's perfect, they don't mean like there's fucking unicorns bringing Kool-Aid to babies that heal them. They're saying even within what you're talking about, there's a form of people equate perfection with pleasure or perfection with no pain, perfection with no death. But no, so no. I mean, I know what you mean. Like that's spiritual bypass, right? You like You say, and you essentially everything's perfect is either holy fuck, you're enlightened and you've absorbed the sum total of all suffering and you are then spontaneously declaring that, or you're saying that the way people pull a blanket over their head, everything's perfect, while someone like a murderer comes into your house with a butcher knife, everything's perfect. So there's two different versions of what you're talking about.
Yeah, and then there are people who can be completely calm through anything because they're psychopaths, you know, so like they've actually like detached themselves from, you know, a sense of being, or maybe not detached them, maybe they're born into this incarnation like that and they're unfazed because they have no feeling. But those people will just easily, you know, come and slit your throat or, you know, kill you, shoot you in the face, whatever. Yeah. So and that's actually part of, I think, what's happening is people are finding some sort of allure either to shutting down as much as they can, which won't work. Eventually it won't work. Or or training themselves into psychopathy. Yeah.
Whoa. Now that, by the way, now that you mentioned that, guys, I'm giving a class. It's called Training Yourself into Psychopathy. If you don't want to take my old roommate's class and feel every fucking thing, why would you want to do that? I will numb you down. So you know what? So it's like, I think, you know, Christianity, everybody thinks the crucifixion is over. And it feels like what you're saying is this, the crucifixion didn't end. We're talking about an ongoing crucifixion of Christ showing up in all of the horror that is manifesting in the world. What everyone thinks, you know, oh my God, you know, it's done, resurrected. But in this process sense, it's like, shit, man, still up there. And we're all standing around. Some of us are like laughing our asses off. Some of us are crying. Some of us are rolling dice. But it's right. Is that the idea? Like we are at the base of the cross. We are looking at this being. And also, to make matters worse, we are that being.
Yeah. I think it's important to balance all of that because, yeah, it's the crucifixion is done in a sense. It's done because it was done for us. That transformative experience happened to the entire earth. It was an event that happened to and for everybody on the planet. So you don't have to be Christian to experience the benefits of the resurrection and the crucifixion. So you don't have to be Christian to experience the benefits of the resurrection and the crucifixion. But that didn't happen just so we could do nothing. You know, like that happened because it gave us capacities to meet challenges that face us. You know, it's like every time consciousness starts to shift, it's like the video game where the level boss just keeps getting harder and harder, almost seemingly impossible. Like, I don't know how I'm going to do it until my muscle memory and like understanding of the level I'm on, like allows me to overcome it. And then guess what? There's one after that. And I have to learn like a completely new technique. But every time, you know, like the way my friend, Patrick Kennedy, he's a priest in a Christian community, but he said like, you know, I know we were just talking about my life. I was going through some hard shit. And he said, you know, I know that God never gives me something that I can handle. Not that I can't handle, which is what, what like, you know, right? It's like, I love it, right?
Right.
Because what's the point? Cool. Why would God give you something that you can handle? Actually, God delivers unto you something that you absolutely can't handle. So you have to turn to him. So that
this is by the way, you just described hell. Hell is where God only gives you things you can handle.
Right, exactly. Totally. That's it. Yeah. Yeah.
Keep going. I'm sorry to cut you
off. No, I mean, that's it. It's just like we receive things that are absolutely insurmountable. So the way that we contend with them is actually by turning to our spiritual life. And when we turn to the spiritual life and our spiritual landscape, but people also just don't know how to turn there anymore, which is really unfortunate. On the one hand, everybody knows how to turn there because everybody in their hearts knows the answer. They just do. And the answer is different for everybody. But on the other hand, we don't really know how to get there in the same way that we don't know how to read until we know how to read. I mean, we have a lot to do. And also a lot of people see spiritual stuff, but they don't know how to read it. And those are two very different skills. So, you know, again, it's something that I am trying to offer out of my own kind of meager failed experience with this kind of stuff, which is nevertheless at least most of a lifetime of trying to contend with it.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Like the situation of like wandering, being lost, the situation of like being so lost you don't even know you're lost anymore. I mean, that's the saddest thing. Like, at least if you know you're lost, there's like some hope. And I feel what you're saying, it's like I think some people have become so transfixed by this, by default reality, which is just the temporary, you know, shared assessment of phenomena, that they think this is it. This is all there is. There is no, it's power. It's such a powerless feeling. It's such a miserable feeling. And it's so dystopian, to find yourself there. For me, you know, anytime I've gotten like transfixed by the goblin at the fairy market, the thing that comes to like shove me or wake me up or get me untransfixed, I get mad. Like, that's my first response. It's like, fuck you. Don't you get it? I'm fucking hanging out with this goblin. I like the goblin. The goblins. You don't like the goblin. Look at his pustules. Look at his oozing pustules. I love popping that goblin zits.
Yeah.
You know, pop my zits. Don't look at that stupid asshole. Come here. Look, there's another one right here. Yeah. So I think what you do, is actually has an element of danger to it, in the sense that you kind of, and you mentioned it earlier, you kind of have to like make people uncomfortable at first. You kind of have to like you, no one likes to be woken up. You know what I mean? Like, it, in what you're talking about is a methodology of, you know, waking people up from this rotten goblin dream or whatever you want to put it.
Yeah, I mean, like, no one wants to discover that the goblin has a hand up their ass that's like moving their mouth like a puppet, you know what I mean? It's like you just think you're like dilated, you know, but then you have to like then you have to pull it out, you know. It's like and like and feel that.
That hurts. Yeah. Especially if you don't know how to pull out, how to let a hand slide out of your ass, man, that can be very, it can hurt.
Do like, a lot of damage the on the way time. Out. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But that is, and also like in yourself, you have to be willing to understand that you might miss things and make mistakes sometimes for a lifetime. Sometimes for an incarnation, you're going to fuck up, and you have to be willing to see that and also not willing to give into it. I mean, it's really not easy. Being human is the hardest thing it's the hardest thing to do in like the universe, really. It's really, really hard. So first of all, that also can bring a lot of forgiveness and compassion to others when you realize that nobody comes here with an easy ticket ever. So I think I think when you're telling people things that are uncomfortable, like you said, when you're confronting them with, you know, I'm gonna maybe, I don't want to say remove your illusions, because I think that that's like the way that very materialistically oriented and conspiracy theorist people talk, like, wake up, sheeple,
red,
you know,
red pill, baby.
Yeah. And I'm not like into any of those people, because they're materialists. So it's like, to me, I'm just like, you're just rearranging the pieces. Like, that's of no interest to me. What's the truth? Which is something much different. But yeah, it becomes extremely uncomfortable. Like right now, I'm trying to mostly talk with people about peace. That is not easy. Right now, I'm trying to talk with people about accessing like real love and peace and compassion. That's not an easy thing to do, because you're confronting and being confronted with all kinds of information and anger and, you know, social constructs. The other thing I'll say is also, when people try to think their way out of a situation, as I said, with the options that are available to them, they often also think that they're doing something very radical just by choosing the other side. So right. like, oh, capitalism, capitalism. Now that capitalism has entered the lexicon of like a popular way of talking about economy, actually talking about politics, but I think they're talking about economy. It's like, then they're like, well, socialism's it. And that is way more radical because they've moved a centimeter and the moving is very hard, but the distance isn't far. So, you know, they're actually just a set. Capitalism and socialism are a set. And, you know, if you move from one to the other, it is actually a radical move because you've completely shifted your perspective. But that doesn't mean that they're radical alternatives. And I know that people are – now everybody hates me for saying that.
Oh, you dead.
Yeah. I know. But I will say that there's a esoteric version of socialism, which I do think is important and I do think everybody needs to go through. And we all need to encounter that. And that is a real radical shift, which is I'm going to look around – like the simplest way of saying it is I look around the room. I look at the floor, the books, the door, the wall, the ceiling, and all of those came from someone's labor and materials that were brought from the earth and effort and pain and strain. And as soon as I start to actually encounter that in my heart, that actually is, I think, that's a real basis for understanding a true living socialism that we can help each other with. But that's not the same thing as just turning the dial on how we handle things economically, you know?
Well, it's like capitalism is one pillow, socialism's the other pillow. It's like in the middle of the night when your pillow gets too hot, you switch pillows. Now I'm dead. You're still asleep. You just got a new pillow and it's going to be cool for a little bit, but then it heats up and then we can do a whole podcast on this. Like it will destroy our lives, but you know, in the conversation of socialism, I like to think about the meta capitalism that shows up in the announcement of being a socialist, that in the announcement of being a socialist, there's all this currency that you accrue from the announcement. So weirdly, capitalism shows up in the conversation about socialism as a meta level of the whatever the particular alignment that you're doing. There is an actual value that shows up in a different form of currency, but currency nonetheless. That's another podcast. this is super cool because to me, what's very exciting about what we always talk about and what you remind me of, which I inevitably forget, is that you don't know all the options. And that the more you think you know the options, the more it's like you're shutting yourself down. You're closing yourself off. You're constricting yourself into a kind of nightmare situation. And I love that. Just like that moment of like, oh my God, I'm free. Because that's what it feels like you're saying is like, you're free as a bird. You are so free. You don't have to be in the world that you're in as you understand it. Whoa, man, that makes my heart flutter, but it still scares me for some reason. It scares me.
Yeah. Well, the reflexive response to that, especially now that I've said something about socialism, which let me just also say that I definitely feel much more affinity with the politics and economy and socialism and capitalism.
Hold on. Let me stop you there. I can see what's on your bookshelf, guys. It's all Ayn Rand. It's like 17 copies of The Fountainhead.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, exactly.
What the fuck?
I'm just thinking of like a fountain made out of like copies of The Fountainhead. I think that would be really fucking beautiful.
And it's blood.
Yeah, exactly.
Blood fountain.
I think like we have to be careful when we have that freeing feeling that we don't stop there. Now that's the accusation that socialists and other leftists generally make against spirituality, and they're right. They're right about that. They're right about, people just want to feel free. They want to feel they want to feel liberated, but not actually be liberated. Now, I think that that might be a little short-sighted, because sometimes feeling liberated is enough to actually liberate you. But yeah. I do think that, like, that's a real concern. And I think, unfortunately you can level that against anything, and you probably should level it against most things, where it's like, you know, if you want something like universal basic income, you have to want it for like a second so you can get rid of it and move to the next thing. Like, you always want to be trying to do something better instead of keeping things in stasis. So what does that look like? So that's why, in my course, but no, it really is why anthroposophy is so interesting to me as a spiritual path. Or as a spiritual approach, because it's had all these initiatives that have come out of it. So it's not just that people are doing spiritual development, although that is where the real site of action is, but it's also that Waldorf schools have come out of it. It's also that biodynamic agriculture has come out of it, and Camp Hill communities. It's that someone had decided, you know, Rudolf Steiner, basically, because people asked him, was like, I'm going to try to bring forward these initiatives into the world. I'm going to try to create a different world with my understandings of spirituality. And there are lots of people who are geniuses in one way or another who have tried to do these sorts of things, whether it's Leonardo da Vinci or Wilhelm Reich, or, you know, who tried to bring forward into different realms of the social organism what they saw. In a concrete kind of working form. So that's why I think that all that's very important. Like I've said, you know, the course's introduction to Rudolf Steiner and the Western esoteric tradition, and I keep saying, you know, esoteric Christianity, because some of the other esoteric Christian thinkers are just as important to me as Rudolf Steiner. Dasklos and Peter Dunov in particular are quite important to me. But the initiatives, I think, are something that shows us some direction and gives us some hope, like, oh, we could actually do everything completely differently. And, you know, Rudolf Steiner is like Aleister Crowley. Good people, anthroposophists would lose their mind to me even saying the same breath, but like, these are two people whose influence has so permeated the world that we don't actually even think of how profound. And Crowley was one path, and it mostly permeated Hollywood and entertainment, actually, through Scientology and L. Ron Hubbard and the Beatles and so on and so forth, and the sort of magical world of commanding the spiritual world. Rudolf Steiner's contribution moved into trying to renew all kinds of aspects of our lives, education and agriculture and religion and, you know, even dance and all these other, you know, aspects. And it shows up again and again and again. And people just don't know that that's what it is. I mean, I named all those people, but then it's like, you even have things like, you know, J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were really influenced by this guy, Owen Barfield, who worked with them. So Rudolf Steiner's like, you know, getting into all of that, like Jennifer Aniston and Suf John Stevens went to Waldorf schools. You know, I mean, I don't know how they think about that experience,
right?
But it's gotten in, you know, and so this permeation
in the culture
through the initiatives is really important, and that's part of why I'm just bringing that caveat against. Well, we don't just stop there when we think of the options; we begin to develop them, and you can't develop it on your own. You have to meet with other people and try to develop them together.
Well, it's like I come up, let's imagine you're in prison. I show up to your prison. I say, Connor, even though you talk shit about socialism, you're letting
– and that's why you're here.
And that's why you're here for 20 years. We've actually commuted your sentence. You're going to be let out of prison. Now, I tell you that. That's the feeling of liberation. Mm. Holy shit, I'm going to be out of prison. But then you still have to walk out of prison, or you're still in prison. You can't just stay in prison pretending you're not there, because you feel, you know, that there's a possibility of getting out. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, I think the sand trap of a lot of new age self-help, mm-hmm. self-development stuff is that the sand trap is you do realize, oh my God, I'm free. There is the possibility for me to be anything I want, untether myself from all the conditioning, live in an unimaginable world because the world I'm in is one that I've imagined based on past habits and indoctrination. And that's where you stop. You're like, great, cool. I'm going to stay in my right. current imagined world. What the radical thing about what you're talking about. And I think you could argue for Crowley too, is both of them have within them. But you got to do it. It's not enough to know where the subway is. Right. You got to get on the subway. And in this case, it sounds like what you're saying is Steiner was intentionally trying to transform the world for the better. And there's proof in what is come out of his teachings. The world has transformed. Things are different. He yeah. created earth-shaking change, and which means that if you're one of his students, that means that it's not enough to just feel good, right? There's an action here. It's a verb.
Totally. Yeah. I love that way of putting it. And I think it's, you know, we'll just turn that critique back on anybody in the political realm as such. Like, people voted right. for Joe Biden and were like dancing in the streets when he, are they dancing now? You know, like they were dancing in the streets when he won the election. Are they dancing now? Like people, you know, try to institute all kinds of social change, whether it's, like I said, universal basic income or gay marriage or things that people believe will be these like completely changing initiatives. And then they stop as soon as they get them. And that's also not good enough. So that's actually one of the problems with a lot of people who are working in anthroposophy and with Ralph Steiner. They are like, they want to refer everything back to the time when he existed and everything that he said and all the initiatives without changing them. So there are people bringing that work forward, and that's what's most important to me. And that's why way back in the beginning when we started talking, I kind of resisted. I was like, well, I wouldn't even know if I would say I'm an anthroposophist or a Steinerian or something like that, because I want to bring it forward. I want to keep working with it and bring it into the world today. He actually, now I'm going to refer to him. He has this like lecture where he says something like, I kind of mess up the quote, but it was something like, if the Sistine Chapel were, you know, painted today, we should rightfully laugh at it for being inadequate. It's like, it's not meeting the time. Like, even the most beautiful thing has to meet the time spirit, has right. to meet, you know, where we are now and the beings that yeah. are present with us and their aims as well. So, you know, I think this also That's resolves so a lot cool. of the critiques of anthroposophy, which are wow. say it's outdated or a product of its time or confused or, you know what I mean? It's like, that's not interesting to me. I want to bring forward what's valuable from it and keep moving. And there are lots of people doing that, but unfortunately, one, not enough people know about what anthroposophy and the Western esoteric tradition embody in it is. And two, the people that really do know, a lot of them are actually holding it back from growth. So it's not, you know, some people have to take up this mantle and try to work with what's there and bring it forward, you know. So I'm trying to do that. It sounds very egotistical, but.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
Well, it doesn't sound egotistical to me at all, at all. It sounds really exciting and authentically liberating and disturbing in the best way possible. You know, good disturbing. Get that goblin's hand out of your ass. And like, let's see what other kind of fisting is happening at this market that we're at. Connor, I'm so happy to have you as my friend. I love chatting with you. Yet again, you have freaked me out, blown my mind. And I hope that, people listening who feel the call will take your class, because it sounds like a nice diving board into something that I think would benefit a lot of people. So how do they sign up for this thing?
Yeah, it's pretty easy. So I just have a square site where they can sign up. So it's so my podcast is Against Everyone with Connor Habib, right? So you can remember it's AEWCH, Against Everyone with Connor Habib, which also spells a witch. AEWCH.square.site. And the tickets are there.
Got it.
Like, they're tiered. There's one for 25, one for 40, and one for 75. That's really mostly just a sliding scale. You get a little extra stuff here and there, but I want people to pay what they feel they can pay. And it's on December Saturday, December 2nd at 9 o'clock a.m. PST, noon EST, and then 5 o'clock Dublin time where I live. And it's just online. I'm just going to lead you through some stuff. There's an extra Q&A that you can sign up for if you want as well. There'll be lots of discussion because I'm going to run people through some exercises and we'll all talk about it if you want to. You don't have to. But then there'll be a Q&A for questions that are completely unrelated, like when people want to ask, like, what did Steiner think about honeybees or, you know, like that kind of stuff. We can talk about that sort of stuff afterward if people want.
Guys, just so you know, I'm going to do this as a little like – I feel like it's – like I have friends where if they offer me weed – to eat, I cut it into fourths. when his friend says this is living LSD, I'm telling you, I don't even know what's gonna happen during this class. But like, I'm not being hyperbolic when I say think about that exercise, that one exercise you did with me once a week. Like it just comes back into my mind. So I don't know what a day. This is a mega dose. So nice. Great. And all the links you need to connect to sign up for this are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com if you can't remember that website. Connor, what a joy. I can't wait to come out to Ireland with the fam, hang out.
I know, man. I know. And every time we talk, I'm glad we have podcasts because it means we can talk because we should talk.
Yeah.
We should talk more, but I always know that this will come around if we wait long enough because I love you and it's great to see you.
Love you. Hare Krishna. Thank you, Connor.
Bye, everyone.
That was Connor Habib, everybody. Again, it's ConnorHabib.com if you want to sign up for Occult Philosophies, an intro to Rudolf Steiner and the Western esoteric tradition. I hope you will. Subscribe to my Patreon. It's patreon.com/DTFH. And bless you, my dearest sponsors, for supporting this podcast and my family. And come see me. All my dates are at DuncanTrussell.com. There's going to be one more podcast this week. And then I'm going to be out for 2 weeks to spend some much needed time with my family and my mistress. I'll see you later on in the week. Until then, I love you. Goodbye.